Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
It's never too early for Lowe's Black Friday deals. Snag some of our biggest savings of the season right now, like 25% off select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees. And get yourself free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit before the Black Friday rush. Because everyone loves free stuff, right? Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 12/3 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
In the early morning hours of February 25th, 2006, 29-year-old Toby Bow and his wife of 10 months, Melissa, were walking home after celebrating Mardi Gras in New Orleans, Louisiana. Just blocks from their house, a black pickup truck nearly hit them at an intersection, then circled back to wait at the next street. When Toby stepped forward to cross, the driver slammed on the gas, striking him head-on before speeding away into the night. Toby was rushed to the hospital where he was pronounced dead. His death was ruled a homicide, however, detectives were never able to identify the driver. Nearly 20 years later, his case remains unsolved, and the question still lingers. Who murdered Toby Bow? Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. So this is another case where a family is really looking for our help. In fact, we worked with Toby's sister Claire on this episode, and this is the first time she's ever worked with a podcast. She and her mother are extremely thankful for us covering this, but more importantly, for you guys listening to Toby's story. And that's what it's all about out here, is understanding that there's a lot of true crime content out there, but not all of them are willing to cover cases like this. The reality is most people are not going to be searching for Toby's case online, which makes it less desirable to cover as a podcast or a YouTube channel. But that's the exact reason we're covering it. We want people to start talking about it. We want people to start searching for it. And the more people do that, the more likely it is for other content creators to see Toby's name and keyword searches, which will incentivize them to cover his case as well. And in a lot of these investigations, that's really what we need. Whatever happened originally when the crime took place, we can't change that. All we can do is help to spread the word and make sure that these victims are not forgotten. This is another classic example of that, and that's why I love Detective Perspective, and I love the community that we've built, and I can't wait to keep growing it because we're just getting started. So let's not waste any more time. I want to dive into this week's case. Toby John Bow was born on June 9th, 1976, to parents Terry and Cindy in Lafayette, Louisiana. He grew up about 15 minutes away in the nearby town of Broussard with his sister Claire, who was 3.5 years older. Their family was close-knit and often spent weekends together attending crawfish and crab boils, something I've never done but would love to do if I ever get down south. You guys are down there, we gotta hook it up. Claire described Toby as extremely thoughtful and inquisitive. She said, quote, "He was a really great brother. He was super reliable too. You could always count on him. He was a good listener. He didn't even have to say anything. He just listened." She remembered how Toby was always ready to crack a joke or make someone laugh, and how he had this infectious laugh and this grin that would just appear on his face. While attending St. Thomas More High School, Toby was known for being an outgoing and respectful star soccer player. He made friends easily, and many of those friendships lasted well into adulthood. After graduation, he went on to the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, where he earned a degree in psychology. Toby then moved to New Orleans and began working in the truck division at Enterprise Rent-A-Car. In his free time, he loved traveling with Claire, going to concerts, and learning to play the guitar. In 2001, when Toby was around 25, he met a woman named Melissa while he was out with friends at a bar. She was attending law school, and the two quickly hit it off. Claire told us, quote, "He was smitten and in love with Melissa. He had found the one. He was just so happy." Toby and Melissa married in April of 2005 and made their home in New Orleans. Together, they built a happy life filled with bike rides, walks, and nights out with friends. Then, in August, just 4 months after their wedding, Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans. The city issued a mandatory evacuation order, and around 1.2 million people fled ahead of the storm, including Toby and Melissa. They were forced to live separately with their families while waiting for the city to reopen. Months later, they returned and tried to pick up where they left off as newlyweds, rebuilding their lives in the city still reeling from disaster. Toby decided to go back to school for his degree in accounting at the University of New Orleans, and Melissa planned to start a family once he was finished. But tragically, Toby and Melissa would never get that chance. They wouldn't even make it to their first wedding anniversary. By late February 2006, New Orleans was starting to come back to life just in time for Mardi Gras. It was a big moment for the city, one that symbolized its recovery and resilience after Hurricane Katrina, giving people a reason to come together and feel a sense of normalcy again. So, on Friday, February 24th, Toby and Melissa were ready to celebrate. They attended a house party with friends and watched parades from the balcony in the French Quarter. It was a great time, and by the end of the parade, Toby was covered in strings of colorful beads. The group then moved to Rendezvous Bar on Magazine Street, where Toby and Melissa sat together in a booth, had a couple beers, and enjoyed their time with their friends. As the night wound down, they decided to walk home since they lived less than 2 miles away on the same street. They had been drinking, but weren't intoxicated, so it was an easy walk. At around 2:20 a.m., as they crossed Jenna Street to stay on Magazine, a black truck suddenly turned the corner, nearly hitting them. They were obviously startled, so they reacted with what Melissa described as, quote, quizzical gestures towards the driver, kind of like, "What the hell? You almost hit us." Melissa remembered Toby shouting, quote, some unknown words to the driver of the vehicle as he drove away. He may have even called the driver an asshole. However, Melissa said she and Toby weren't aggressive or threatening in any way. And after that, the two just kind of brushed off the incident and continued walking home like anybody else would. But one block later, they reached the intersection of Cadiz Street and Magazine Street, and what happened next, no one expected. We're going to talk about it right after the break. As a busy parent, it's been such a game changer to do my weekly food shopping with Hungry Root. Hungry Root plans all of my meals for the week, shops for me, and delivers groceries that fit my health goals, dietary preferences, and budget. And what I just said there is really important. Hungry Root helps you eat well and reach your diet or health goals, whether that's gluten-free, dairy-free, high protein, focused on gut health, or anything else, they got you covered. All you have to do is take a quick quiz, and their smart cart technology recommends groceries and recipes tailored to your taste and needs. Unlike other food delivery companies, Hungry Root now has over 50,000 chef-crafted recipes to choose from every week, with many ready in just 15 minutes or less. And with over 1,000 grocery items like smoothies, sweets, kid snacks, salad kits, ready-to-eat meals, and supplements, it's easy to find options that fit everyone's taste and nutrition goals. And Hungry Root holds all of its food to high standards, screening out over 200 additives, including high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and preservatives. They source only high-quality meat and seafood with no hormones or antibiotics, or for organic produce and non-GMO options, and carry trusted, healthy brands like Oatly, Vital Farms, Ithaca Hummus, Harmless Harvest, and many more. I love Hungry Root. I've been using them for a while, and I knew that I had an ad with them tonight. So I'm like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to eat only food from my Hungry Root box. So I started the day with vanilla yogurt and pineapple. Delicious. It was absolutely fresh, delicious, loved it. And then I made their extra quick chicken Caesar salad, which is, it's just a chicken Caesar salad, but the chicken was fresh. All the ingredients were good. The salad was awesome. And I topped it off with a sweet, because if anybody knows me, I got to have my sweets at the end. I had the mini crunchy chocolate chip cookies, and they weren't just any chocolate chip cookies. These are a more healthy brand of chocolate chip cookies that I'd never seen anywhere else. So big shout out to Hungry Root. Absolutely love their options. So take advantage of this exclusive offer. For a limited time, you can get 40% off your first box, plus get a free item in every box for life. All you have to do is go to hungryroot.com/detective and use my code detective. That's hungryroot.com/detective, code detective, for 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life. You ever go through something tough? Maybe a breakup, burnout, or even just that creeping anxiety that doesn't let you sleep at night and you're laying there thinking, I wish I had someone to talk to who actually gets it. I've been there, and I've seen how powerful therapy can be, not only for me, but for my friends, for my family, and for the people close to me who were really struggling and needed help. But let's be honest with each other, and I think we already know this, getting access to the right therapist can be a nightmare. You call around, people aren't taking new clients, they're not in your network, or it costs a fortune. That's where Rula comes in. Rula is changing the game. They make high-quality mental health care accessible and affordable. Most people pay only $15 a session, and they take most major insurance. You answer a few quick questions, and you're matched with a licensed professional who meets your preferences, and you can be talking to someone as soon as the next day. And by the way, Rula has over 15,000 therapists and psychiatrists in their network. And Rula doesn't just leave you hanging after that. They actually stay with you, checking in on your progress and making sure you're getting what you need out of therapy. Whether it's a therapist or even a psychiatrist to help with medication management, Rula's got you covered. So if you've been thinking about therapy, or even if this is the first time you're considering it, this is your sign. Thousands of people have already trusted Rula to support them on their journey toward improved mental health and overall well-being. So head over to Rula.com/detective to get started today. After you sign up, they're going to ask you where you heard about them. I'd really appreciate it if you support this show by telling them that I sent you over. Once again, that's RULA.com/detective, and take the first step towards better mental health today, because you deserve quality care from someone who cares. Okay, we're back from break. And before I get into this next part of the episode, I first want to give you a rundown of the street and where we are so that you have a visual going into this. So on the screen right now, if you're watching on YouTube, you are seeing what we have here running east to west is Magazine Street. So you can see that right here. And then over here running north to south is Cadiz Street. And what's important to know is that this is Magazine Street is a two-way street. Cadiz Street is a one-way street. So it's running north to south. And you can see here, again, if you're on YouTube, I apologize if you're not, you have this do not enter sign, which is also a stop sign. So you can take kind of a layout. I'll do a spin here. You can see the buildings, because I am going to be showing you some crime scene photos in a couple minutes. And you're going to see these buildings again. So at least you'll have like a point of origin and you can have an idea of the orientation that we're looking at here. But overall, what you need to know is, as I'm pointing right here with the arrow, this is the direction that Toby and Claire were walking. They were walking east to west. And the vehicle that we're going to be talking about is going to come into play from this way. So let's get into that. And then we'll come back to the photos and you can compare it to Google Maps. So we just had the map on the screen. So for anybody who saw that, or even if you're listening now, you have an understanding of the area that we're discussing. So Melissa and Toby approached that intersection again. And at that time, they noticed the same black truck that nearly had run them over just minutes earlier idling at that stop sign that I had just showed you on Cadiz Street. So clearly it had circled around to confront them again. So at that point, Toby steps into the intersection because they have the right of way. There's a crosswalk and there's a stop sign. And as he steps into the roadway, he raises his arms, signaling for the driver to stay at the stop sign while they cross. But instead of waiting, the truck driver pulled forward, stopping about 3 feet in front of him. And at that point, Toby began shouting at the driver, though Melissa couldn't recall exactly what he had said. Then, without warning, the driver slammed on the gas and the truck shot forward, hitting Toby head on. The impact sent Toby under the vehicle, and then the truck dragged his body several feet through the intersection as the driver kept his foot on the gas. Melissa later told CNN, quote, "Toby's body had kind of tugged and he was just tumbling underneath the car, and so every few seconds, I saw his face." Horrific. We were going over this. Even Shannon, the editor, put a note in the script saying this is absolutely horrible, and I couldn't agree more. Having that visual that you have to live with for the rest of your life is just horrible. And when Toby finally came loose, the driver sped away, fleeing south on Cadiz Street. Melissa was just left standing there in complete shock. She said, quote, "It was so horrific. There were Mardi Gras beads shattered all over Magazine Street." So Melissa immediately called 911 as a handful of people came to help. They had witnessed everything from their own vehicle, which was traveling east on Magazine Street. There were two people in the front seat and two people in the back who had been asleep until the impact. The driver of the car ran to Melissa while the others rushed to Toby to try and render aid. Paramedics arrived soon after and transported both of them to the hospital. Toby was tragically pronounced dead on arrival. He had suffered blunt force injuries to his head and body, skull fractures, and a fractured vertebrae. His cause of death was listed as blunt force trauma, and the manner of death was homicide. Toby was an organ donor, so even in death, his generosity helped others. Claire told us, quote, "It's in line with his character and the things that made him stand out. He was always helping others. It's how he lived his life." Back on Magazine Street, crime scene investigators and homicide detectives worked to process the scene. In the roadway, detectives found a number of items: Toby's broken Mardi Gras beads, strands of hair, a tooth, a pool of blood, and his watch. Now, if you're on YouTube, you can see this drawing that I have on the screen right now from police. It's a very simple drawing. You can see Cadiz Street running north to south, Magazine Street running east to west. And at the northwest intersection, you can see that they have marked on it, they have beads. And then across Cadiz Street on the other side of the intersection, let's call it southeast and southwest, you have a couple more markings that were made. You have hair, you have beads, and it looks like you have a pool of blood. They don't have the watch marked on here. And then just to take it a step further, I'm going to show a couple photos. I have many photos, including photos from the hospital. I will not be showing those. But the first one we have here is the street signs. Little side note, that's something that we should always be doing as investigators. It may seem obvious, but you always want to take a picture of the street signs. So if these photos ever get lost or you need a point of reference, or if someone's not familiar with the crime, they always have this to start with so they can pull it up on Google Maps, just like we're doing. The second photo that I'm going to show you is a photo where you're basically on Cadiz Street looking north. So if you go back to the Google Maps photo, you can see the white building on the corner there. And that's the corner that both Toby and Claire would have been stopped at. And where the white police car is under that yellow tape, that's where the black truck would have been. So you have Toby coming off the sidewalk there, being hit at that intersection more on the north side of Cadiz Street, and then being dragged underneath the car to the south side of Cadiz Street, which you can see where those orange markers are. And then on marker number 3, if you look here, you can actually see the beads that Toby was wearing. And I could be wrong, but the reason this photo stood out to me is even though they didn't mark the watch on the drawing, it looks like this black object here with the beads could be a watch, although I could be wrong. And there's some other photos of the crime scene, were just different directions of the streets, which should have been done. And it just gives you a clear point of reference of where you were and what it looked like at that time. So I will say I give a high score for the photos. Whoever took those were good. I liked that. Although I wish all of the investigation was done the way these photos were taken. And we're about to get into the actual investigation right now. And I do want to say, by no means is this an easy case. This is a tough one. You're going to have an area where it's not a lot of cameras. It's kind of a residential slash commercial area. And you have eyewitnesses, but no one with a clear visual on the driver. So you really don't have a lot to go off here, although that's where you earn your paycheck. That's where you go find the evidence because it's not laying there on the ground in front of you. But we'll go over everything and then we can probably dive into it a little bit more. So you got the photos, you got the layout, you know where we're talking about here, and you can, if you have a visual representation of it, so you can go along with me on this ride as we kind of go through it. And so at this point, now detectives are out at the crime scene and they also began interviewing witnesses that same night as well. The two people who had been awake in the nearby vehicle described exactly what they saw. A driver in a black truck ran Toby over and then fled the scene without stopping. The witnesses described the truck as a, quote, Toyota type of vehicle with a rounded front and a chrome accent over both wheels. It was, quote, fairly new and shiny, possibly a Tacoma with tinted windows and no visible dents, markings, or bumper stickers. Because of the dark tint, the witnesses were unable to get a clear look at the driver or determine whether there were any passengers inside. They didn't see the license plate either, which it's a huge blow. That would have really helped us. And honestly, if they got the license plate, I wouldn't be sitting here right now talking about it. And after speaking with those witnesses, detectives went to the hospital to speak with Melissa. And understandably, she was visibly shaken and unable to provide a full statement at that time. However, she did tell detectives that when a friend arrived to meet her at the hospital, they noticed that there was a dark truck driving unusually around the parking area. And so at that point, detectives collected security footage from the hospital, though it's unclear whether anything came from it. I have to assume the answer to that question is no, but would it be completely unheard of for the suspect in this case to drive by the hospital and see what happened if the person who they hit was severely injured or dead? It's happened before. It's definitely happened before where maybe even they park their car, get out and walk around to see if they can find out how much trouble they're in. So this was a good observation by the friend, but unfortunately, if they were able to gather that security footage and nothing came of it, it's kind of a dead end. Although I would at least like to see documentation in the report to show they saw the vehicle, were able to identify it, and went and spoke with the owner of that vehicle just to ensure there's nothing there that needs to be looked into further. Later that morning, Melissa was able to give a full statement. She talked detectives through the entire night, starting at the Mardi Gras house party, then the bar, and then finally their walk home. And she explained how the two had encountered the same black truck, with the second time ending in Toby's murder. Melissa told detectives that Toby hadn't argued with anyone at the party or at the bar, and she even went on to say that he didn't have problems with anyone outside of that night either, no issues at work or conflicts with anyone in his life. So to her, none of it made sense, and it felt completely random. Melissa said that after seeing Toby get hit, she went into complete shock and couldn't focus on the truck as it fled. Still, she was certain that it was a mid-sized Toyota, and like the witnesses had said, she described it as fairly new and shiny without any marks or bumper stickers. And that stinks because those distinguishable marks are sometimes the difference in whether the case is solved or not. So that's extremely unfortunate and unlucky. She also told detectives that she believed the driver was a white male, though she couldn't be sure. The windows were tinted dark and everything happened so fast. But during the first encounter on Jenna Street, she thought she saw a white male behind the wheel. And we're going to come back to this because this is a major problem. It's not any fault of Melissa or the other witnesses, but not being able to positively identify the driver if you happen to find a matching vehicle, that's going to make the case extremely difficult. And we're going to revisit this in the perspective. After interviewing Melissa, detectives canvassed the area around Cadiz and Magazine, looking for additional witnesses and any possible evidence now that it was light outside. They spoke with nearby business owners and employees, but because the incident happened around 2:30 a.m., most of the businesses were closed. But I do appreciate the fact that they went back to the scene, because I can tell you right now, when a crime happens at night, it's like a needle in a haystack. And when you go back that very next morning, it feels like a whole new world. And I have found critical evidence the next day in more cases than you would believe. And so even though it was unfortunate that many of these businesses were closed, they gathered whatever surveillance footage they could find, though there wasn't much available. At that time, you have to remember that cameras weren't as common as they are now, and with the city still recovering from Hurricane Katrina, that made it even rarer, because some of these businesses that had cameras, they were destroyed in the storm. As I'm sitting here right now, based on everything we know from the police reports, even the footage that they were able to obtain, there wasn't anything that was helpful in the investigation. But based on everything they had learned at that point, detectives concluded that Toby was killed in a, quote, deliberate burst of road rage. They told the public they had no immediate suspects, but were actively searching for the black truck and its driver, who was possibly a white male. Detectives kept investigating. They contacted local body shops, hoping someone might have brought in a damaged truck for repairs. But again, as far as we know from the reports, no leads came from that effort either. Meanwhile, Toby and Melissa's friends and their family started their own outreach. They distributed flyers throughout the city and spoke to the media, pleading for witnesses to come forward. According to The Advocate, a billboard with the case details was put up, and a $20,000 Crime Stoppers reward was announced. And this is significant. Again, we're going back to 2006, $20,000. That's a lot of money now and then. And this is an area that's struggling economically. So if you had someone who had seen something, or maybe was a friend of a friend and knew who was driving this truck, you would think that they would come forward, and yet nobody did. But I will say this, tips did come in. And I don't know if they were related to the reward that was being offered. What I do know is that none of them led anywhere. And as the months went by, the case began to stall. Detectives told the family that police were at a disadvantage in the wake of Hurricane Katrina because the city was still recovering and resources were stretched thin, and both staffing and budgets were limited. I know this is going to be a tough pill for many people to swallow. And that's where I think I can add value, because I think at this point, most of you trust and respect me, or at least I'd like to think you do. And I was in a supervisory position as a patrol officer, as a sergeant at one point, both in the narcotics division and in the patrol division. And I can tell you, this is a real concern here. When you have staffing issues or you have budget issues, it does limit your capabilities. And now think about this natural disaster that occurs. And it's not just in this one location, it's happening all over the city. And if you remember, this wasn't that long ago. I know I remember it. It was like World War III down there. You had the National Guard down there. It was all hands on deck, and it was an absolute disaster. A lot of people didn't have homes. There was a lot of crime occurring. And I could see how law enforcement would just be completely tapped out. And you can't get blood from a stone. So anybody who's worked in any job, I don't care what it is, whether it's at a gas station or for a Fortune 500 company, you're only able to carry out the responsibilities of whatever jobs you have based on the staffing you have available. You can't do things when you don't have individuals there to perform the tasks needed. And no family should have to hear that your case isn't being investigated as thoroughly as it should be because of staffing or budgets, but that is the reality of it. I'm not saying it's right or it's fair, but it wasn't the New Orleans Police Department that caused Hurricane Katrina. They were victims of this tragedy as well, and it was something that no one could avoid. So I'm not saying it's okay. I'm not giving them a pass here. I just think it's important that we all acknowledge the significance of Hurricane Katrina and how much it affected that community. So to have something like this happen at that particular time was just a really unfortunate set of circumstances and timing. What I don't like hearing is that soon after making those comments to the family, Detectives gave up on investigating, leaving the family feeling abandoned, and Claire said that she was haunted by the sense that something crucial was missed in the early days of the investigation. And that's terrible. Regardless of staffing, regardless of budget, regardless of how busy I was as a police officer, as a detective, I always tried to at least give the appearance that I was working the case as hard as I could. And I'm not saying I'm lying, but when a family member would call me, even if I was really busy with another case that just happened the night before and I had been up till 4 a.m. working a new murder, I didn't get on the phone with this family member who was asking for a follow-up and say, hey, listen, I'm tapped out. I'm working new cases. Sorry, can't help you. You know, you put a spin on it. Yep, we're still actively working it. I'm fielding leads as they come in. We have been busy and we've been tied up, but trust me, I haven't forgot about your loved one and I'm on this until we solve it. Regardless, if something comes in and you want to talk to me or you just want to come in here and try to get an update, as soon as I'm available, I got you. Come on in here. We'll go over everything. We'll make sure we're dotting our I's, crossing our T's. We're all in this together. So the fact that the family felt like they had been abandoned and left alone to find justice for their loved one, Toby, that's wrong. Regardless of what was actually transpiring, even them just feeling like that way is a failure on behalf of the police department. I wasn't in those buildings when they were working the case, so I don't know what they were actually doing. But if the impression was given to these family members, and this is their perspective, so this is a fact, this is their truth, then that's a failure by the administration and the investigators working the case, because that's part of our responsibility to make sure that those families know we work for them and their loved one, and they should never feel like we're letting them down or leaving them on their own. Over the years, Toby's family rarely heard from detectives. When they called, their questions went unanswered, and at times, they didn't even know who was assigned to the case. Then in late 2023, more than 17 years after Toby was killed, Claire was told by a friend that a former high school classmate of Toby's was posting about him on Facebook. Claire knows this person by name, but she's asked us not to use it because that way he doesn't get any attention, which is what he might be looking for. So I'm going to refer to him as the classmate. Over the last few years, the classmate has made a lot of posts about Toby to the point where it could potentially be considered cyberstalking. Now, some of his posts are about how much he loves Toby, and at points, it appears that he might be infatuated with him even though they were never actually friends. And sometimes the classmate even posts these creepy photos he took of Toby's elementary school or even the burial site. So really weird stuff. And then there's also times where it escalates even further. And in these posts, he includes descriptions of physically harming Toby, specifically mentioning hitting him with a car. After seeing all of these posts, Claire was deeply unsettled, as anyone would be. But at the same time, she felt reinvigorated in the search for answers. She wanted detectives to know what was being shared online, so she reached out to the New Orleans Police Department and eventually made contact with the Cold Case Division. That's when she learned that Detective Wayne Rumor was currently assigned to Toby's case. Once they connected, Claire told him about the classmate's post, and Rumor said he would look into it. He later called her back and said that he had spoken to the classmate by phone. He told Claire that while the classmate was mentally unstable, he didn't believe he was a viable suspect, and he said it wasn't worth pursuing any further. But Claire disagrees. She finds the classmate's posts and behavior disturbing and believes he should be questioned again, at the very least, in person. So allow me to weigh in here because you have two sides of this. I don't know either party personally, so I'm going to give you my perspective. Do I think this guy is connected to Toby's murder? Probably not. I don't think the person who hit Toby is online bragging about it. Do I think this person has a weird connection to Toby, whether that's indirectly or directly, just through the years of knowing him from a distance? Absolutely. Is he mentally unstable? Probably, although I'm not a doctor. Now we get to the question of, should he be investigated further? I agree with Claire. I think we need to go the next step. We need to fully vet this person to ensure that they have no connection to Toby's murder. And that would involve going and meeting with him, finding out what vehicles he owned during the time of the incident. Did he or his loved ones own a black Toyota truck. Where was he on the night of Toby's murder? Was he down in that area? Can everything that I just mentioned be done over a computer or on the phone? Sure. But that doesn't mean it should be. You had the victim's sister reach out to you. Clearly, she's in fear of this person. She doesn't know who they are. They're posting some weird shit online. So I'm going to go out there. I'm going to vet this person. I'm going to question them again, if for no other reason than to make clear, feel like I'm doing everything I can. I'm going to give my full effort. I'm going to make sure he has an alibi, make sure he doesn't own a truck that matches the description of the car in question. And at the end of our conversation, I would politely suggest that he stop posting things about Toby on Facebook. It's disrespectful to the family and it's disrespectful to Toby. And regardless of his intention, it could potentially rise to the criminal level at some point. And if I had to come back and speak to him again, it could be to arrest him. Just to see if I can prevent him from doing it in the future, to maybe give Claire some peace of mind. That's how I would have handled it. But that's just me. We still have a lot more to talk about because clearly Claire wasn't happy with the work that was being done by Detective Rumore. So she took things into her own hands and got the case files for herself. We're going to talk about it right after this break. The countdown is on. Holiday shopping season is officially here. Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique, high-quality finds you won't see anywhere else. So don't wait, because the most meaningful gifts get scooped up fast, and now is the perfect time to cross names off your list. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, making every gift feel meaningful and truly one of a kind. I was actually just on the Uncommon Goods website because I'm looking for some unique wall art. So I went on there and I typed in wood wall art, because if you've seen my background on Crime Weekly, I love everything wooden. It's just, that's kind of my style. Look at my desk. And I went on there, typed it in, and sure enough, these cool things start popping up. I seen this one piece of art where you type in your favorite song and it takes the waveform from that song and turns it into a piece of like wooden wall art. That was really cool. And then I also found this vertical wooden chessboard. Never seen that before. Didn't even know it existed until I went over to Uncommon Goods. That's the type of stuff you're going to find there. And Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, and diehard football fans to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. And when you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Many of their handcrafted products are made in small batches, so shop now before they sell out this holiday season. Plus, what I love, they give back. With every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. And they've donated over $3 million to date. So don't wait. Cross those names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/detective. That's uncommongoods.com/detective for 15% off. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. All right, so I need to tell you about this podcast that's absolutely blowing my mind. It's called Buried: Inside the John Wayne Gacy Investigation. You think you know this story? Trust me, you don't. Bob Mata from Defense Diaries has access none of us ever will have. His father was actually Gacy's defense attorney, and Bob has actual recordings of their conversations. But Buried: Inside the John Wayne Gacy Investigation goes way beyond just those tapes. This is a real-time investigation, and Bob and his producer interviewed the actual detectives who worked the case. And these guys are finally talking, admitting to things they've kept secret for over 40 years. Constitutional violations, evidence that mysteriously appeared, systematic failures that let young men disappear while police wrote them off as runaways. If you've already watched the Peacock series, this goes even deeper than that, because this isn't just about the monster. It's about the dangerous line between justice and truth. It's about the victims who deserve better and the system that failed them. The remastered recordings, they're chilling. But the investigation Bob conducts, that's what makes it essential listening. So check it out, Buried: Inside the John Wayne Gacy Investigation. All right, so before break, I mentioned that Claire wasn't happy with the status of the case, and I'm sure it didn't help that when she brought Detective Rumor a lead with the classmate, it was kind of, in her opinion, a half-hearted effort, and it didn't felt like it was fully vetted. So at that point, now that she was in contact with Detective Rumor, she submitted a request for all of Toby's case files, and Rumor sent them over. And that's when Claire discovered that there were no records after June of 2006. That realization was devastating, as it meant no one had investigated Toby's case in 17 years. And if any tips had come in over the years, there were no notes documenting them, not even her own report about the classmate. And that's a major problem, because as people retire and new investigators take over the case, they should be reviewing everything in that case file. And if people are doing work on the case but not documenting it, it didn't happen. There's no way for me as the new detective to know the last thing that was done and who has been talked to. So this is a major issue, and there's no excuse for it. And Detective Rumor can say, hey, I wasn't the only person working this. That may be true, but as I just mentioned, there was an interaction with an individual that was brought to you by the family who was making some very disturbing posts online, and you may have followed up with this person, but if it's not written down, it didn't happen. I tell you guys that all the time. So at minimum, Detective Rumor didn't document what he did. Worst case scenario, he didn't call the classmate at all. And I really hope that's not the case. So as Claire continued to review the case files, she noticed other troubling gaps. There was no indication that the police had ever checked ownership records for Toyota trucks in New Orleans or anywhere else, and only a few interviews had been conducted, Melissa's and the other witnesses who saw the hit and run. If there were more interviews conducted, again, they weren't documented, so how would we know? Detectives never questioned anyone from the house party or at the bar that night, even though not everyone was someone Toby or Melissa knew. And that is another problem, because even though on the surface it may look like a road rage incident, there is still that possibility that something happened, maybe even inadvertently, during the time at the house party or at the bar where Toby or Melissa pissed someone off. How do you know that's not the case if you don't investigate everyone there? And if they did do that, again, sounding like a broken record, it's not documented. And if it's not in the report, it didn't happen. And let's just explore that theory a little further, right? Because Claire had told us that people had speculated that maybe Toby unknowingly offended someone that night. And she went on to explain that if someone had said something inappropriate to Melissa or one of her friends, Toby would have said something back. But as far as we can see, there's no record that detectives ever explored that possibility, and that's a problem, because our job is not to assume, it's to follow every possible scenario until it's no longer viable. And it doesn't appear that that was done. To make matters worse, according to Detective Rumor, as of today, Toby's case is, quote, very cold. Yeah, no shit. And there's nothing more they can do unless someone calls in a new tip. But Claire disagrees. She believes people can still be re-interviewed, vehicle records can be checked, and the classmate can be fully investigated. But it doesn't appear that that's what detectives are currently doing. Despite all of it, Claire refuses to give up. She continues to push for a full investigation, and in recent months, she helped secure a new reward for information in Toby's case. She remains determined to get answers for Toby, Melissa, and their families. Claire told us, quote, I know that someone knows something. Someone saw something. Someone heard something. Or someone was told something. I just want that person or those people to stop hiding and speak up. I pray for this person to just do the right thing and confess. I know that it's never going to bring Toby back, but there's something to be said about doing the right thing so that others can move forward. She added, quote, justice for me, I don't think it will ever come. Really don't. But for someone to confess, it would do wonders for me and my family. All right, so let's dive into the perspective, and it's going to be a little different tonight because Claire had some questions that she wanted me to answer in the perspective, so I'm going to do my best to kind of structure this perspective around that. And the first one was, How far should Claire push the classmate lead with room war? Can anything else be done with the weird things that the classmate is currently doing? And, you know, she's pushed him. She can go back again to say, hey, listen, just for my peace of mind, can you go out there and talk to him? Can you make sure that he didn't own a Toyota around that time and no one in his family owned a Toyota? And can you possibly try to get an alibi for the night in question? That would mean a lot to me. And also, can you go out there and tell him to stop what he's doing? And if I were Detective Rumor, I would go out there to do it. Even if I didn't feel it was going to lead anywhere, just out of respect for Claire, I would take, you know, an hour or two out of my day and go down there and talk to him and try to find out what I could and meet him in person and let her know that I spoke to him and I warned him to stop posting this stuff online. As far as what she can do, I think it's very simple as far as the Facebook level is concerned. I think she has more than enough cause to contact Facebook, her and her family and her friends and any of my followers to report this account and let them know what he's posting and how detrimental and traumatizing it is to the family. And I would like to think that Meta would take action and take down his account so that he can no longer post these things in a way that people could see them. This is an active investigation. It might be cold, but it's active. And he's essentially stating that he would want to harm this person that was murdered. So it, at minimum, it's wrong and it shouldn't happen and it has no place on social media. And if it continues and he's directing it towards the family, then potentially it could get to a level of cyber stalking. But I will say cyber stalking cases are extremely hard to charge and prosecute. It's just, you need a lot. I have had very little success with them. Another question that she had was, what actions would I take after looking at the case almost 20 years later? And the first thing that I would do is pull up the records from the DMV. I would look for vehicles ranging in years from 2003 to 2006, fairly new vehicles. I would pull up maybe a 20, 30, 40 mile radius of any vehicles that are a Toyota black vehicle in that area matching that year range. And I would try to narrow it down to people who have addresses in that area and have white or Hispanic owners. That's what I would try to do. Now, if I had to guess, black Toyota trucks in that area owned by someone white or light skinned, I would imagine there would be a lot of them, hundreds, if not thousands. And what you would do at that point is, if you have a reasonable number, I don't know, under 100, go around and see if you can talk to those owners and find out where they were during the incident and if any of them had their vehicles tinted. Another thing that I would do to try and narrow down the search without having to really go out and reach out to these owners individually, which could take months, if not years, is pull up all Toyota trucks from that age range, 2003 to 2006, and try to find something that matches the description, and then take it to all the witnesses, including Melissa, and see if they can positively identify the vehicle in question, because there's a lot of Toyota trucks out there, and I would like to narrow it down so I know specifically what vehicle I'm looking for. And the more detailed information that I have, the more narrowed down my search can be in the DMV records. So maybe we get that number from 100 down to 30, which is much more manageable. And then you go out to these owners and you look to see who had this truck around that time, where they were living, what they were doing on Mardi Gras for that year, and did any of them have their windows tinted? Maybe you get something, maybe you don't. I won't lie to you guys, it's a long shot. You know, I pride myself on calling balls and strikes on this channel. And when I stop doing that, you should stop listening. And I'm not going to lie to you, this is a tough one. And the major reason that it's so tough is not even identifying the vehicle. It's identifying the driver. Because hypothetically, let's say I found the vehicle. I have to prove that the owner of the vehicle was the one driving that car on that night. How do I do it? Nobody saw the driver as far as we know. They saw potentially a white male. So even if I find the car, I can't put this driver in a photo lineup because nobody's going to be able to identify him. So at this point, even if I go through that whole search, even if I find the vehicle, there's still a possibility that I can't tie anyone to that driver's seat on the night in question. That's the major hurdle here. You really need someone to come forward who knows the driver and say, hey, listen, I was either with him or he told me he did it. And you can build a case around that person without them confessing. I would go to body shops to see if anybody brought in a damaged truck. I would look for sales of Toyota trucks around the time that this hit and run occurred. I would also go to the local tint shops to see if anybody brought in a vehicle matching that description around the time that this incident occurred. Again, if we are able to identify that it was a 2004 Toyota, then I would bring that truck, a picture of it, to all those tint shops, to those owners, even if they're not in business anymore, and say, hey, did you tint out any windows around that time? See if they remember something. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain. And the final inquiry that Claire had for me was, are there any other questions she should be asking Detective Rumor? Claire, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not in the business of spreading false hope. I don't think there's any other questions you need to ask him. It's clear that Detective Rumor feels like there's nothing else to investigate at this point. I'd like to think that if new leads come in, he'll do his job. But at this point, he feels like there's nothing else to do. And I can tell you, as a supervisor in that role, you can't make him go out there and work. So I personally feel like it would be a waste of your time and energy to try and elicit some type of response by asking a certain question. You want the reality of it? This case is going to be solved by you, by us. And so what you can actually do, instead of asking Detective Rumor questions, would be exactly what you're doing right now. Spreading Toby's story. Making sure that everyone knows what happened to him. 20 years ago, nobody's talking about this case. It's our job now to make sure that everyone knows his name. And by doing that, more people are going to search it, more people are going to talk about it, and more people are going to get frustrated. And that's when you create that pressure, that external pressure that gets applied from the top at the politicians and then goes down to the chief and then the captains and then the lieutenants and then the sergeants and then down to the detectives. Shit rolls downhill. So if people start talking about it and the media start talking about it, that's when people get off their asses and start doing their job. So we got to go out there. We got to make some noise. We got to make sure that everybody knows about this case to apply that pressure, but to also make sure that if there's anybody out there who has any information that could help solve this case, we reach them because they're not going to come to us. We got to go find them. And this is the start of it. You've waited a long time, too long, but we're not going to give up hope. And we're in this for the long haul with you. We're here to help as much as we can. And I'm hoping that my coverage of this case is just a start. So I want to make sure that anybody who's watching or listening to this episode right now has all the details just in case they know something. So just to recap, 29-year-old Toby Bowe was struck and killed in the early morning hours of February 25th, 2006, while walking home with his wife, Melissa. His murder took place after attending a Mardi Gras party in New Orleans, Louisiana. A black pickup truck nearly hit them at an earlier intersection, then circled back and intentionally drove into Toby at the corner of Magazine and Cadiz Street before fleeing the scene. The driver of the black truck was described as a white male, but he has never been identified. If anyone has information about Toby's murder, they should contact Crime Stoppers at crimestoppersgno.org or by calling 504-822-1111. There is a $2,500 reward. My final words, as always, go out to Claire, Melissa, and all the friends and family of Toby. Like I said before, I just gave out that recap. We're in this together. The true crime community is powerful. I've seen what we're capable of. We have solved cases harder than this. This guy's out there somewhere. He's a dummy. Somebody knows what he did. Somebody saw that truck. Maybe it was parked at one of these establishments in that area before the crime occurred. Somebody has to remember something that could get this case going again. We just got to find him. And you're not alone in this. You may feel like the New Orleans Police Department abandoned you, but we're not going to. We're here to help in any way we can, and I'm hoping sooner than later I'm sitting right here letting everyone know that we get the scumbag in custody. But until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon. Actually, sorry, one more thing. Almost forgot. Next week is Thanksgiving, and I'm going to be off, and I hope all of you have a safe and happy holiday. I will be back after Thanksgiving, so everyone out there, I will see you soon. Have a great Thanksgiving.